أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.
Hello, welcome to another Islam in Focus program. Assalamu alaikum, peace be unto you. We continue with our series today dealing with the political system of Islam, with the discussion of the choice of rulers in Islam. I'm your host, Tamer Rashid, and I have joining me as usual Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Could I have you very quickly summarize the main points that we touched on in our fourth program in the series dealing with the political system of Islam?
Sure. The main point, as you indicated in the introduction of the program, is the issue of how a ruler in Islam should be chosen. And we indicated that the cardinal rule, the most important, the fundamental rule in Islam, is that the ruler should be chosen with the free choice of people, not to be imposed on them in some way or the other. In analyzing how this happened in the model that we regard as the perfect model, if you will, or near perfect model of the implementation of Islam, we started looking as to how the Prophet and the first four caliphs were accepted as leaders. In the case of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, we said that his case was quite different, even though the principle still applied. But it was different from the caliphs in a sense that he was both a prophet and a head of state, combining both offices. But in any case, we have seen again that the Prophet would have not been in that leadership position without the overwhelming support and acceptance of the majority of both his prophethood as well as his leadership as a head of state. And we have indicated that even in the case of the Prophet, they have been the bay'ah or pledge or oath of allegiance or loyalty, which was given, so there still was acceptance by the masses. Mm-hmm. We went on then to analyze the choice of the first caliph or successor to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as head of state, Abu Bakr. And we indicated that Abu Bakr again was chosen with the consensus of the people, even though the procedures in each case might have varied from the first caliph to the second, third, or fourth, but the principle was there. In the case of the first caliph, we said that when the news of the death of the Prophet got around, there was some meeting called by the Ansar or the original residents of Medina, in which they suggested that one of them would succeed the Prophet. There were some discussion. Some of the Muhajirin or migrants joined the discussion. So after some free discussion and presentation of alternatives, Abu Bakr was nominated. But the most important thing that was emphasized in the previous program, that even though Abu Bakr was nominated by what you might call the leaders of the people, or the most respected members of the community, it wasn't binding on the community, and he did not gain legitimacy as a ruler until the following day when he went to the mosque, which was like an open meeting place, and the masses came also and pledged fealty or the loyalty, the oath of allegiance or acceptance of the person as a ruler. In the case of the second caliph that we discussed briefly also, we said that still the principle was there, even though the methodology varied with the needs of the time. And we said that when the first caliph was on his deathbed, people approached him and actually gave him some kind of authorization to suggest or nominate one person to succeed him so that the amount of disputation or degree of disputation would be minimized. And then we said that he did some consultations, and then he finally came up with the nomination of a very prominent companion of the Prophet, that is Umar, the second caliph. But even then again, it wasn't really appointment, as some people might have interpreted that. It's not, he has no power to appoint someone on people, regardless of their will or choice. Mm-hmm. It was simply a nomination based on people's confidence in his suggestion. But even in the case of the second caliph, legitimacy was established only when he went to the mosque, like his successor did, his predecessor Abu Bakr did, and people came and accepted him, pledged allegiance and accepted him as a caliph or ruler. And the same principle was implemented at least in the case of the third and fourth caliphs.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps now in today's program we could turn to an examination of the situation with respect to the selection of the remaining two rightly guided caliphs. Turning first of all to the third, Osman, could you perhaps explain the circumstances surrounding his selection as caliph?
Okay. Similar situation was or has risen when the second caliph, Umar, was dying. He also made a sort of suggestion to avoid too much conflict and division, but again by way of nomination. And what he suggested was a different way, really. He nominated or named six prominent companions of the Prophet. And these companions were among the known ten. You see, in Islamic traditions, there are ten particular companions of the Prophet who received explicit glad tidings that they will go to paradise, which means, of course, that both Allah or God and the Prophet were very pleased with their faith and their commitment, and that they would live their life and die as true believers. And these six, just for record of history, included Ali, his cousin, Osman, who came to be chosen as the third caliph, Abdurrahman ibn Auf, Sa'd ibn Mu'adh, Az-Zubair, and Talha. These were the six that Umar nominated. And he was quite strict. He said, you know, these six should meet together and they should agree among themselves to nominate or choose one person that is to be accepted or to be suggested to the people, and that there should be no division and nobody should deviate. Once there's some agreement on that, everybody should unite in that choice, at least among the six. So what happened is that in the meeting of this committee, if you will, one of those six, Abdurrahman ibn Auf, made a suggestion. He addressed the people and he said, the six people, or the other five, if you will, and he said, who among you offers to withdraw his nomination or to be out of it, not to be considered for to be a caliph or successor or ruler, provided that he would do his best to make a nomination for someone who is best or who is most qualified to do it? There was some silence, but he took the initiative. He said, all right, I am out of it. I don't necessarily, you know, want to be a ruler. So they agreed with him that he would act as a sort of, you know, like chairperson or initiator on behalf of the group. He took an oath from them that if you have given me that trust and confidence or whatever we decide, everybody should, you know, fall in line. And they agreed. He did a number of approaches, if you will, or methods to try and find out what the consensus really is. So he approached the two perhaps most prominent, I think most people who say this are the two most prominent members of this committee of six, Ali and Osman. And he went to each of them individually, in private. He went to Osman and he said, suppose you were not the one to be chosen to be a ruler, who do you think would be the most deserving? And Osman answered, Ali. That is, he would trust Ali, the cousin of the Prophet. He went and repeated the same thing for Ali. He said, Ali, if you were not chosen as the ruler, who do you think is the most deserving and most qualified? And Ali said, Osman. In addition to this, two other prominent members, Az-Zubair and Sa'd, they also indicated their strong preference of Osman. But this was only one way of getting first some sense or feeling within the committee itself, within the six. And in addition to this, Abdurrahman ibn Auf, that chairperson, if you will, spent several nights meeting, discussing and consulting with the companions of the Prophet, the most prominent people, and in addition to consulting even with common people, common men, if you will, people especially who came in deputation for Medina, to Medina, took some opinions from them and some feel. And he found that both Ali and Uthman seemed to be quite acceptable and strong candidates, maybe with some edge, slight edge for Uthman, the elder, because he was more, you know, elderly, and perhaps, you know, both of them were very good, but at that particular point, the need seemed to be called for a person like Uthman, at least in the judgment of the majority. In addition to this, he held a general meeting after dawn prayer, Fajr, you know, this dawn prayer which is usually performed about 75 minutes before sunrise. And in the dawn prayer, there were so many people in the mosque, included people who migrated from Mecca to Medina, included some of the original residents of Medina or Ansar. It included some of the leaders of deputations of armies, or other people who were in what you might call business trips, business relating to the running of the state, you know, official. And a public discussion was held. Without getting into all the details, there was so much discussion about the virtues of Uthman and the virtues of Ali. And finally, it ended up with the conclusion in the mind of Abdurrahman ibn Auf, when there was some kind of slight edge in, as he could gather, in favor of Uthman, to offer fealty or to offer the pledge of allegiance to Uthman, and people accepted that. They also made the same kind of pledge. Again, notice here that it was only when this nomination, if you will, was accepted by the masses, then Uthman gained legitimacy as the third successor or ruler after Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon
him. Very interesting history. What about now turning to the discussion of the fourth and final likely guided caliph? Could you give us the background of the selection of that caliph?
Okay. I'll try to do that in a brief way, because it perhaps could be understood a little better by going into some historical background as to the kind of commotions that took place during the reign of the third caliph, Uthman. But perhaps maybe the place for these details might come into under a different series, perhaps on Muslim history. But to cut the story, a long story short, there were some commotions and difficulties during the reign of Uthman. We're not analyzing now the causes behind these commotions, but many historians agree that the most important reason might have been the fact that Islam spread so fast, so quickly, and large number of people followed Islam in so many different diverse areas, and they did not have the chance to really grow in Islam under the supervision of the Prophet and really absorb it. So there were some still, you might say, carryover of their olden days. But aside from that, the commotions, in any case, ended up in the assassination of the third caliph, Uthman, who was a very pious individual, and perhaps you could do that in history. Following the assassination of Uthman, the situation was quite, you know, confused, depressing, if you will. At this point, Ali, who was actually like almost an equal candidate with Uthman, when Uthman was chosen, was very depressed and didn't like what happened at all, and was very sad, of course, for the assassination of that innocent, very righteous caliph, Uthman. And he actually isolated himself, he went away, you know, to in seclusion. Some of the prominent companion of the Prophet went to him, and they begged him, they said, listen, you know, at this particular time, in this situation, we can't really think of anyone who is more qualified and more competent and deserving than you to be the caliph, the fourth caliph, to succeed Uthman. Some historians tell us that he was reluctant even. He said, well, I would prefer wizarah, that is, I would prefer even to be an advisor or to serve rather than to be the ruler, which is, by the way, the character of all caliphs. All of them were humble, all of them did not just run for, you know, power, because the office they occupied was an office that required a great deal of sacrifice. It's not like today's you know, rulers having all kinds of fringe benefits, if you will. It was far from that. The ruler was expected to sacrifice more than the common person, even. But they insisted on him. He said, we cannot accept this proposal or nomination of yours unless it is in the mosque, because the mosque was the common place where any Muslim can go and express his or her view. It should be in the mosque and with the acceptance and consent of other Muslims. Which again shows the same basic principle adhered to in the choice of all four caliphs, that the freedom of people to choose and to approve or not to approve a person nominated. So it shows that regardless of the specific method or mechanism, you might say, by which each of these four rightly guided caliphs was chosen, in all cases the principle was there: nomination followed by bay'ah, or pledge of allegiance.
Well, in your analysis of the method of choosing all of these rulers, these first four rulers, you've used this term bay'ah several times. Perhaps it might be appropriate to ask you to just elaborate a bit more on the concept and what's involved.
Okay, the term bay'ah literally comes almost like from a deal, like when you buy or sell, you know, where you have concluded some kind of a deal, which includes a sort of commitment on both parties. That term appears in the Quran in at least three verses, in two surahs. One is called Al-Mumtahana and the other is called Surah Al-Fath. There were three incidents where we find reference in the prophetic life about this bay'ah or pledge of allegiance or loyalty. One was the bay'ah of women. That is, when women came to the Prophet, and the Quran directed the Prophet that if they come and give the allegiance, that they would follow the path of truth, which includes, of course, all aspects of life. Then it says, فَبَايَعْهُنْ, it addresses the Prophet that you should accept their oath of loyalty or allegiance. And just to make a cross reference, in our discussion in the series on social system in Islam, when we talked about the so-called political, quote-unquote, rights of women, we indicated that this concept of bay'ah, or oath of allegiance, is an early reference to the right of election, or the right of women to choose or to give allegiance or acceptance of their leader, which is equivalent today to participation in election. And we're talking here about in the 7th century, 100 years ago. But just a cross-reference to what was covered before. There was also another incident of bay'ah, or oath, or pledge of loyalty and allegiance, which was done in Al-Aqaba, it's known as the first Aqaba allegiance, which included a few persons from Medina, Ansar. That was during the period of pilgrimage. And there was a second Aqaba oath of allegiance, which was like a preparation, really, for hijrah or migration of the Prophet preceding his migration from Mecca to Medina. In all of these pledges, if you will, the more common aspect, really, or the most common aspect, is that it was an allegiance or pledge to accept the leadership of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as a prophet and as a head of state or leader. As a prophet, in the sense of obeying whatever he communicates to us by way of revelation he receives from God. Secondly, to accept him also as a head of the Muslim community, as the, you know, the final authority, if you will, in determining their affairs or disputes. So in a way, the concept of bay'ah is more or less like the concept of election, or referendum, if you will. But it's even more broad than the simple choice or the simple election. Because in election you're simply saying, all right, by referendum or by vote or ballot, I accept X to be the ruler, or choose X to be president or whatnot. But in the case of bay'ah, the pledge is more than that. It goes beyond this. It is also an oath or pledge on the part of the person doing it to obey the leader or the head of the state, so long as he's not doing something against the Quran or the prophetic directions. And it also includes a pledge to advise and correct the ruler if he makes a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a broader concept than a simple election. As far as the scope, who should participate in bay'ah, in principle, any Muslim has the right to participate. However, in the early days of Islam, it was not too practical when Islam spread so fast and means of communication and transportation were not available as it is today, to have everybody from all Muslim countries gather in one place to give this bay'ah, or oath of allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
So in the early days, it was mostly the people in Medina, which included the early Muslims, which was justified in a way because they actually represented really the conscience of Muslims. They were the ones who received the directives of the Prophet. They lived with him, they absorbed Islam with him, they sacrificed a great deal. So they were people who must understand Islam and its spirit. And practically, again, they were the ones in the center of the government, if you will, of the time. However, we find that even in the case of the first four caliphs, there were also participation by deputations or people coming also from other places. You might recall early in this program, when we were talking about the choice of Osman, we said that among the people who participated in the discussion and
yes.
the choice in the mosque were representatives from other places also
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, the principle is there, but the mechanism, of course, could vary mm-hmm. depending on the needs of the time.
That's a very interesting concept. I wonder if I could ask you perhaps to give an example of how, in your opinion, this could be applicable in this day and age.
I mean, the basic principle of freedom of choice?
Yes.
Of the rulers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so long as the principle is adhered to, any mechanism or method that does not deviate from basic rules of Sharia or divine law, if you would be acceptable. And this is something beautiful about the way Islamic teaching responds to the needs of place and time. There are certain principles that one cannot get out of or go beyond, because otherwise things will get chaotic. But on the other hand, in terms of details, methods of implementations, it is left to the needs of place and time. So what I'm saying now is not necessarily the way to do it,
mm-hmm.
but some of the possible ways of implementing that principle in today's situation, for example,
mm-hmm.
under the present circumstances. One possibility, which would not contradict Islamic law, is to have a nomination of one person. This nomination could be made by either a trusted person that the community accepts, as Abu Bakr, for example, the first caliph, did. Or it could be a nomination by a group of people who are chosen by other people or trusted or regarded by them as the representatives of their views and their understanding, or gain their trust. This could be one. Secondly, it could be also a nomination after consultation. That is, the nomination would be made after some mutual consultation between people who are accepted in the community as representatives of the people's views and understanding. There is nothing that prohibits a mechanism whereby you have an elected council, and that council among themselves either choose one person to be a head of state, or even a person outside of that council. Just like when you say a parliament, for example, or people's representative assembly, if you will, to choose one. Thirdly, it could also be a public referendum, just like the typical elections that we have today one person, one vote. There is nothing that I know of in Islamic law that says you can't follow that. This is also, if the people are reasonably educated and they know what they're deciding on and they're mature enough, there's sufficient circulation of information where people can make an intelligent choice, this perhaps would be quite desirable to follow as a method of choosing a ruler. As indicated earlier, these are only examples of possible mechanisms that would not contradict, to say the least, would not contradict the spirit or letter of Islamic law. And this is basically what is accepted and understood by the overwhelming majority of Muslims.
Well, I know that you use the term overwhelming, not unanimous, which would suggest that there may be other views in terms of how this can take place. Can you perhaps shed some light on those views as well?
Well, there are very few things in this world which are totally unanimous.
Yes.
The main reason I use the term overwhelming majority is to try to be as honest to God and to myself as possible by not ignoring even some opinions that might not necessarily represent the majority, which might even be a small minority. There is just we're trying to be careful in the expression. But in any case, the reason basically is that there is a minority opinion that differs with that basic principle. And this is the idea or concept of Imamite, which is followed by a group of Muslims who are known as the Shia or Shiite Muslims. The Shia represent approximately 10% of the world Muslim population, and their basic position is that the question of headship of the state or the community of believers is something which is very fundamental. It is fundamental of faith. They don't regard it as a matter of, let's say, choice of the people or ijtihad, something where people can reason and choose what they feel is best for their situation. They say no, it is a matter of faith, of articles of faith. And basically they say that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as they believe, specified that the one who should succeed him should be his cousin, Ali. May Allah be pleased with him. By the way, this is the same Ali that you talked about before, who actually was chosen by the public, Muslim public, to be the fourth caliph. But they said no, he should have been the first, and he was specified as an appointed person, and that people should not really choose the ruler, but every ruler chooses or appoints his successors. In other words, they say the Prophet appointed Ali to be his successor, so Ali also appoints his successors, and that successor appoints his successor, so it goes almost like a sort of hereditary, if you will, within only the household or even one segment of the household of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. They believe further that those imams or those rulers or successors are infallible. They are not like any other human being. They are infallible, and they say it's essential to have a ruler who is infallible. And they believe that the 12th, in this succession, as they believe, the 12th imam went into a cave more than 1,000 years ago, and that he's going to come back before the Day of Judgment to fill the world or earth with justice after it has been filled with injustice. It's sort of, you know, similar to the concept of the notion of Messiah or some, you know, deliverer, if you will, coming at the end of the time. The implication of this minority view, I should say, is that a ruler is not to be chosen freely by the people, that it's just a matter of succession or appointment. A view, of course, that, needless to say, is not accepted by the mainstream of Islam, really, or the 90% or so, more than 90%, I should say, do not accept that. The 90% view is the one that has already been discussed in the last two programs.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to stop at this point because we've exhausted our time. Mm-hmm. We want to thank you for watching. Invite you back next week when we'll continue our discussion. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله.